Good morning. On today's programme, the Russian-operated kamikaze drones which are terrorising Ukraine and the French environmentalist seeking an end to the practice of keeping whales and dolphins in captivity. But first we go to China and Beijing, where the Chinese Communist Party's 20th Congress opens today. It brings together more than 2,000 delegates from across the country and is where President Xi Jinping is expected to be reappointed for a third five-year term as head of the party and the military. The reaffirmation of President Xi as leader effectively sees the scrapping of a system credited for the orderly transition of leadership, which was in place in 2002 and in 2012, and it puts Xi Jinping in a commanding position to lead into the future. Yvonne Murray has reported on China for RTE for several years. She sent us this report.
Sometime on Thursday, on a nondescript overpass in northwest Beijing, a lone figure carried out a rare and dangerous act of sedition. The protester hung two banners from a bridge and lit a fire to draw attention to the incendiary words scrawled in big red characters. We want food, not COVID tests. We want reform, not cultural revolution. We want freedom, votes, dignity, not lies. We are citizens, not slaves. And remove the dictator and national traitor, Xi Jinping, the banners read. The protester, who also shouted the slogans through a loudhailer, was quickly arraigned and bundled into a police car, unlikely to ever be seen or heard from again. But not before. Photos and videos of the brief event, taken by pedestrians and motorists below, began circulating online. Censors worked fast, suspending WeChat accounts and scrubbing the internet of anodyne words like bridge and even Beijing. Still, internet users found creative ways to reference the protest. We all saw it, wrote one. An isolated incident, perhaps. After all, a solitary protester on a relatively obscure bridge does not a revolution make. But the fact that it took place just days ahead of the most sensitive event in the Chinese political calendar was a stark reminder that even in Xi Jinping's heavily surveilled China, dissent exists. But how far up does it go? That's the question many are posing as Xi prepares to begin his third term as General Secretary of the Communist Party, the most powerful figure in modern Chinese history since Chairman Mao. With an iron fist pumping ideological purity, Xi Jinping has remodeled the Communist Party and by extension China in his own image. Chinese state media has long been brought to heel. Academics and civil society groups have been silenced. Political enemies have been disposed of. Today, Xi Jinping thought his own personal brand of Marxist-Leninist politics, ensuring the supremacy of the Communist Party in all domains of public and private life, is taught in classrooms from kindergarten through to university. All of this should make Xi Jinping unassailable. But when you've made it to the very top of elite Chinese politics, staying there is the difficult and often dangerous game. Which brings us to this week's 20th Party Congress, where thousands of delegates from all over the country gather in the capital to discuss matters of the day. Of course, as always, all the real decisions have already been made behind closed doors by the elite. And with so much at stake, Xi Jinping will no doubt have already carefully calculated his next moves. And so those outside the Communist Party inner sanctum are left guessing. Will he, won't he, unveil a successor this time? Or will the seven chosen men, and yes, it's always men, who walk onto the red carpet as the new standing committee of the Politburo, signal that Xi Jinping is safely staying in power for life? Observers will also be reading the tea leaves for signs that the government might relax its dynamic zero COVID policy, with its yo-yoing lockdowns and enforced mass testing. Zero COVID has been the source of much disgruntlement. But it still maintains widespread support, a point of pride in contrast to the chaos in democratic countries, a narrative the government happily peddles. But what of its impact on the economy? For decades, China was an economic miracle, boasting double-digit growth and rapidly rising living standards. But in the past 12 months, with the economy still battered by the pandemic, the leadership set about reining in some of the drivers of growth, like private sector tech and property companies, as part of Xi Jinping's common prosperity policy. Meanwhile, deepening US-China rivalry has created problems for some of China's international trade. Imports into the US from Xinjiang, where China's accused of human rights abuses, for example, are now heavily restricted. And the problem's not going away, as this week's ban on US companies selling components to Chinese computer chip makers shows. But casting the outside world, in particular the United States, as the imperialist villain trying to contain China's rise is an undeniably powerful narrative at home. And no doubt Xi Jinping will lean on it to tell his party and his people why they need to stick with him. There's an old adage that the most turbulent times in Chinese history surround the arrival of a new emperor. Xi Jinping is likely to make sure that for him, that moment never comes. For World Report, I'm Yvonne Murray.
To Ukraine next, where several cities were terrorized again this week as Russia fired long-range missiles and dropped bombs on civilians and infrastructural targets in retaliation for an attack on the Crimean Bridge. Some of the bombs were dropped by so-called kamikaze drones, unmanned weapons technology being used to wreak death and destruction on the people of Ukraine by Russia. From Odessa, Hannah McCarthy reports.
"They sound like motorbikes in the air," said one person. "You can hear a roar, and then suddenly an explosion." This is how people in the Ukrainian city of Odessa have described the unmanned drones that have been swarming around Ukraine since September, attacking cities and military targets. They're called Shahed 136 drones. They're triangular in shape and about 12 feet long, and they typically carry bombs weighing up to 30 kilograms in their noses. That's enough to take out a military vehicle or badly damage a building. Rocket launchers are used to fire the Shahed drones from up to 2,000 kilometers away. The engine of the drone then takes over and can fly at a speed of almost 200 kilometers an hour. They have the potential to hit specific targets at a distance, which is something that Russia sorely needs to do while facing a well-resourced Ukraine. The drones explode on impact with their targets. This is why they're rather darkly known as kamikaze drones. They're named after the Japanese air pilots who would fly directly into enemy naval vessels during World War II, killing themselves in the process. The drones fly at low altitudes and are often not detectable on the standard radars used by the Ukrainian military. In order to overwhelm air defences, batches of the drones are also usually launched together. So where exactly are these Shahed drones made? The answer is Iran, although the government in Tehran has denied selling the drones to Russia. The Ukrainian government isn't buying it, though, and it stripped the Iranian ambassador to Ukraine of his credentials in September. With Russia sanctioned by the West, though, there aren't many countries other than Iran who could replace the Kremlin's dwindling military supplies. The Kremlin's supplies have clearly not dwindled enough, though, to stop them launching ferocious missile attacks across Ukraine last week. They bombed cities as far west as Lviv in what was seen as a response to the attack on a major bridge built by Russia on the Crimean Peninsula, which was annexed from Ukraine in 2014. Reports coming out of Ukraine suggest that Iranian drones have managed to inflict serious damage on Ukrainian military targets, as well as key infrastructure. "They want panic and chaos. They want to destroy our energy system," said President Volodymyr Zelensky in a video address on Telegram. The Ukrainian Ministry of Defense said it has managed to stop most of the drone attacks with its missile defense systems, but says it needs more sophisticated technology to properly defend itself. President Zelensky has appealed to Israel to supply it with their more sophisticated Iron Dome defense system. But Israel, which has traditionally had strong links with the Kremlin, has found itself walking a careful line with the war in Ukraine, despite the country having a significant Jewish population. A lot has been said about Ukrainian bravery in the face of the bigger foe, Russia. But fighting drones has little to do with courage on the battlefield, and everything to do with who is willing to supply you with the best technology. For example, drones have played a decisive role in the civil war going on in Ethiopia right now. In May last year, Tigrayan rebels in Ethiopia were marching on the capital, Addis Ababa, after a string of military successes against government forces. Then the country's president, Abiy Ahmed, secured foreign drones from his allies, including Iran. Since then, the drones have effectively erased the rebels' territorial wins and forced them to retreat to Tigray, where along with millions of civilians, they're facing massive food shortages and power blackouts. Ukraine itself has been using drones, including the American Switchblade drones, that are far more sophisticated than the Iranian-made Shahid drones. These types of unmanned weapons have helped Ukrainian forces in the east. Overall, the Iranian Shahid drones are unlikely to significantly change the course of the war in Ukraine. But they are a stark reminder that the next phase of this conflict depends less on the bravery of soldiers on the battlefield and far more on the decisions being made in government buildings and military bases around the world. As democratic leaders, autocrats and generals decide what weapons to supply and what advantage to give one side. Because of course, nothing is ever fair in war. For World Report in Odessa, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Finally, we go to the south of France and a story of environmental campaigners seeking to lure visitors from marine parks which keep dolphins and whales in captivity for entertainment shows. The SOS Grand Bleu is an organisation which prioritises the protection of marine life and argues for the long-term preservation of the Mediterranean's ecosystems, as Connor Power reports.
The Mediterranean Sea, and in particular along the coast of the French Riviera, has long been the subject of ecological debate. Stretching back to the days of Jacques-Yves Cousteau's resistance in 1960 to the French government, who planned to dump nuclear waste there. Snorkeling along the shorelines of the built-up city of roughly 4 million people that is the Côte d'Azur, I'm always impressed by the amount of life present, particularly compared with the shorelines in Ireland. Everywhere seems to be teeming with fish of various types, colours and sizes. If there's overfishing, one doesn't see any evidence of it on a cursory coastal inspection. There is, of course, much to protect, from overfishing to pollution and the inadvertent poisoning of marine life such as turtles and whales. I spoke to Muriel Auriol, a mission director of SOS Grand Bleu, an ecologically charged association that has been fighting the good fight for the sake of the long-term health of the Mediterranean for over 3 decades now. Amongst SOS Grand Bleu's stated priorities are the protection of the marine environment, and more particularly of the dolphins and whales in the Mediterranean Sea, and the long-term protection and sustainable management of the Mediterranean's ecosystems. SOS Grand Bleu also campaigns to end the use of whales, orcas or dolphins in captivity for dolphinariums or entertainment shows. The biggest one in the area and in all of Europe is Marineland, a popular dolphinarium just outside of Antibes between Nice and Cannes, which attracts over 1 million visitors per year to watch trained sea mammals such as dolphins and killer whales perform. The managing director of Marineland, Pascal Picot, maintains that the animals are well treated. Moreover, in September of 2021, Marineland published a list of some 80 signatories from scientists around the world, some, albeit working in other zoos, declaring that zoological institutions have never been more useful than they are now towards the study of and the protection of species. "We'd completely disagree with that," says Muriel. "There's a large scientific weight of evidence that tells us it's not possible to study such animals in captivity where they don't have the same behaviour patterns at all. These are animals that range hundreds of kilometres per day, so you can't consider the behaviour of a dolphin or a killer whale as normal when he's in a tiny pool." A large part of SOS Grand Bleu's mission involves education, and every year more than 3,000 young people and adults are taken on board their floating school, the Santo Suspiro, for a day-long trip where visitors are educated about the nature of sea life in the Mediterranean, to observe sea mammals in their natural environment, and to pick up any sea trash they find. The Santo Suspiro is a beautiful timber sailboat and replica of a 16th century Turkish caique, a boat favoured by Turkish pirates in days of old. It cuts a dashing presence at the end of the long jetty in the harbour of Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat, just east of Nice. Once on board with the two crew, Captain Arnaud and Muriel, and 15 or so paying members of the general public, Arnaud and Muriel begin their explanations of how the organisation was formed 32 years ago, how it purchased the Santo Suspiro in 2005, and about the fact that although they normally see dolphins and small whales out at sea with a 75% success rate, there's never a guarantee that we'll see anything. After an hour or so, we're over 20 kilometres out to sea. Here we're almost alone, with no speedboats or aircraft overhead, and with only the occasional luxury yacht passing by. And it's then that the first school of dolphins makes its appearance. With running commentary from Captain Arnaud and excitement running through the people on board, There's no question of going straight for the dolphins, but running alongside them in the same direction and at a respectable distance. If there's any interacting to be done, then the dolphins are the ones who will decide. 6 hours after departing from port, after a day of scanning the seas, watching several dolphins and one sunfish play in their natural environment, and having picked up a couple of kilos of plastic en route, we're back at the long jetty in Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat. Everybody on board is in good spirits and feeling elated by their day out at sea. I try to recall the last time I watched a dolphin or a sea lion show, but in light of what I've just seen, it's hard to picture it because there really is no comparison. For RTE World Report at Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat, southern France, this is Connor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.